I remember once we were together in a festival. We were sitting one next to another.
Yeah.
In Porto Gruaro, a festival dedicated to Russolo.
I remember this. Yeah.
And there was a concert with the Intona Rumori.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
And there was a new piece, or sort of a new piece.
Yeah, yeah.
That was composed by Silvano Bussotti.
Nice.
And
oh, I remember that
when song. when he operated the devices, Russolo's Intona Rumori, and he made some gestures also on the piano. And I remember you saying this beautiful line, "Oh, this is the good old avant-garde."
This is the good old avant-garde.
Which is not a contradiction per se, but it means that once, I mean, Bussotti is somehow older than you, and he started working in the late 50s, and but he had, I would say, preserved in his way of performing and acting a touch, a specific approach to the gesture, to the instruments, which you aptly dubbed as good old avant-garde. And this probably is what you were meaning about.
Yes.
How?
Exactly. But not only, but in the case of Bussotti, it would be more like a, I would say this in Italian, un gentile terrorista musicale, a very sophisticated musical terrorist of great taste. No, perché questo, because this music in its time had the power to shock. Had shocking power, mm-hmm. as did Stockhausen,
yeah.
as mm-hmm. did Ligeti, Xenakis.
Mm-hmm.
These people, they brought out music, people, wow!
Yeah.
Everyone, oh my God!
Mm-hmm.
It was.
And that was at the time when the audience looked for surprises.
They were expecting something new.
Yeah.
And this is why I think this terminology that's become universal now, new music. Well, I mean, all music is new. Every time you listen to Mozart, it's new. But the new music which is made under the rubrica of, am I speaking English or Italian? Under the title of new music, of course, is a continuation, in fact, of the classical art music of the past. But we think of it as new because we're living in a time when we're not sure what is new and what is not new anymore. Because the entire repertoire, as all of these archives will demonstrate, is still living today, perhaps living more than the music which is produced by living composers today. And this has become a problem for people like myself who are living composers. Beethoven and Mozart never had this problem.
Right.
They were the composers
right.
of their time. For a certain class of people and for a certain cultural
right.
Life activity. But today it is, there's an immense, I would use the Italian word intreccio, there's a coming together of so many strands of musical culture which are dominated in large part by economic forces that we have no control over, and even sometimes cultural forces. So that a small sector, let's say like country and western music, which I like a lot. You wouldn't think so, but I do.
I think that you like everything. Or I like everything. Everything.
So this music, which is essentially, you know, which is a music of essentially a folk origin, is now one of the leading, at least in some parts of the world, especially in central, southern, and western United States, and you will go to Japan, and you will go to China, and you will go to Indonesia, and you will go to Alaska, and far reaches of the corners of the world, you'll hear music which is very, very much like country and Western music. And so this music is everywhere. And yet it's only a small little folk music, but it has an enormous economy. It's worth billions of dollars. It produces enormous amounts of money for the producers. And I am the worst, most uninformed economist in the world, but it's not uninteresting that two of the most interesting books written about contemporary music are written by French economists. You know what I'm talking about. Mm. I can't read the...
Attali.
Attali is one, and then the other more recent economist has talked about the same thing. And this is really interesting because economists, see music as something, we see it as immaterial, they see it as material. This is the interesting. Yeah. And part of the problem of the avant-garde is the refusal of the avant-garde for philosophical reasons, for political reasons, and maybe spiritual reasons to deny the, at least in their imagination, that music and money had anything to do with each other. I mean, his case in point, Musica Elettronica Viva, perfectly classical, radically left, politically left group founded on individual equality and collective action and sharing everything. And we had another idea about what to do with our material earnings and how to share those things. But no one ever thought that there could be money produced by this music, especially not even the composers. Although gradually, as this music began to become not popular, but began to acquire a its own place in society, composers like Berio, Nono, Ligeti, Stockhausen, Boulez, and so on.
Yes, but these were they became established composers because there was an important public support provided by radio stations, festivals, publishers,
editori.
Of course, when you're talking about Musica Elettronica Viva, which was kind of a subversive endeavor in a way. But this came from a very specific and, I mean, and I would say also historically and very unique situation that happened in the mid-60s among a community of expatriates in Rome.
That's true.
Which is a key, I always reflected upon this because this was really a unique situation. It was also, I think for me, it has also some political nuances and not casual. I mean, because there was a moment in which some individuals like you, like Frederick Jevsky, like Richard Teitelbaum, all the others that went into that group, then formed the group, came from the United States, from serious musical studies in the universities of the Ivy League.
Very serious.
And would you like to summarize a little bit now? How was this situation? Because I noticed that simply looking at your website, when you started your biography, and you say that everything begins in 1965 in Rome, as if nothing had happened before.
Well, this is interesting because you bring up something that that I've also written about quite seriously in my writings, and that is the gradual recognition that the post-war Italian composers, many of them I got to know personally, and especially the composers in Rome, and I can speak of Franco Evangelisti and Domenico Guarcero and Gisto Macchi, and people whose names may not resonate very widely. But the group who were originally the founders of Nuova Consonanza, which as a cultural institution, as a musical avant-garde institution, was clearly a living and important presence in the history. So I came into this picture, as you say, with a bunch of American young, energetic expatriates. We didn't think we were going to change the world, but we didn't deny the possibility that we could. And this is in the context of the entire global world revolution of youth in the middle and late 60s. And underlining that are an enormous and rich history of artistic practices that were happening at the same time. Just to name one, solo performance, where a composer or a musical person, let's say Diamanda Galas, for example, presents herself as her music, just her. She plays, is, lives, promotes her music all alone. Lamont Young, same idea, and so on. So this became also for economic reasons. It's much easier to travel as one person.
Right.
It costs less than travel with an orchestra. And yet, at the same time, we have Steve Reich and Phil Glass, who formed small orchestras and ensembles and traveled with them. I actually performed with not both of them, but I with Steve Reich several times.
Did you perform with Steve Reich?
Yeah. I did one
tour.
Summer tour. I think it was in 67, 68.
As a keyboard player?
As a keyboard player, yeah. One of his keyboards got sick. I met them in Rome. And he said, hey, are you free? And I joined the group.
That was
it was the group with Gavin Bryars and Michael Nyman.
Okay.
That played drumming for the first time.
Drumming. There was also Cornelius Cardio was involved.
Cardio
was there.
It was an incredible ensemble.
Wow.
I mean, this is a piece of history that that could even make a little book of itself. Just those characters all together in one place, all due to Steve Reich. Okay, so I'm getting far afield here.
No, but we'd like to go back to that moment in Rome, but also I would like to know something that is sort of unrecorded, which means your American formative years. I mean, there's a fantastic picture of you as a child.
I don't know which
this
one.
Guys as a probably in uniform.
Oh, with a trombone.
With a trombone.
Yeah.
So you came from your family background was musical.
Yeah, my father, yes, and my mother. My mother played the piano. She actually played music for silent films when she was young. She did that for work, and my father was a multi-instrumentalist, primarily trombone, but also he sang. He had a beautiful tenor voice and sang in many local choirs and synagogue and here and there, and had his own dance band. So he was, and this is why the music of dance band is always in my music.
This happened in New England, right?
It happened in Providence.
Providence, Rhode Island.
Yeah,
Rhode Island.
Yeah, right. So we're bringing in many threads of my past to going back to my childhood roots. But those childhood roots were still very much alive when I found myself living in this exotic Mediterranean wonderland. As I say, a wonderland, because for Americans at that time, young people like myself, it was a place where literally one could live on $1 a day as far as money was concerned. So it was cheap and it was a lively place, and the elements mixing in and out from Cinecittà to, let's say, to the Nuova Consonanza world produced someone like Morricone, who was doing both, improvising on his trumpet with the Nuova Consonanza and writing film music by for the what's his name, the
Sergio Leone.
Sergio Leone, thank you. Yeah. And so, and so these worlds were it was lively. It was, I say, exotic. Yes, of course it was exotic. There were serious things going on. No one could imagine their own future development, but there was, I would say, a clear command. And by command, I say, not comandamento, but or ordine, but there was an understanding that we had the power, potential power, to change things. By things, I mean the political and cultural equilibrium between men and women, between money and no money, between a life of working slavery or slavery work that most people carry out in their normal daily lives, and the life of a more open and free, almost more spiritual without the religious connotation, a more spiritual life through making unusual sound. Simple as that.
Yeah. This is very interesting and fascinating. And I think from the from an historical perspective, for me, it's always, I always wonder how and why this discovery from your part and other, the other Americans, for example, I'm thinking always of Frederick and, and Richard.
Richard, sure.
How this happened once that you were in Rome in that particular moment, because I always talked with another Alvin, Lucier.
Lucier, sure.
Who told me, it was older than you, and he also came to Rome.
He shared, he lived in a one-room studio, which I later rented after he left.
Ah, okay.
Yes, it was one of the poorest. I think it was a room no bigger than this.
Ah, you mean the place?
Yeah, a place where he. And anyway, we can, those are details which we can save for another time.
Details.
But it's curious that we did overlap. Yeah.
But he told me that he was trained as, I mean, academically, as an academic composer.
Yeah, yeah.
He wrote neoclassical pieces.
That's right.
And once that he was in Italy, and he had experiences at the Studio di Fonologia in Milan, for example. And he, for the first time, he witnessed the music of John Cage. He discovered the music of John Cage in Italy.
In Italy, yeah.
And that's curious. And that has changed his life and his way of conceiving and making music.
That's interesting.
It's interesting because this happened here and not there.
I could say the same for myself.
Yeah, and so there must be something special that was going on at that moment.
Well, I mean, I can tell you, not only did... I had met John Cage, in fact, this is a very interesting point. at Yale University, where he was invited not by the music department, who refused to invite John Cage, but by the Department of Philosophy. So Cage came and did a concert. Of course, it was scandalous, and it was produced by the philosophy department. And later, I had many occasions to meet and actually work with Cage in Europe on projects of my own and projects of his through the Westdeutsche Rundfunk and various things with Klaus Schoening. So, but what I'm saying here is that these encounters, more importantly, our meeting, I say our meeting, a very important meeting with two important events in the history of MEV and mine personally, not only with Lamont Young, Terry Riley, and the whole American school, who was imported by Fabio Sargentini in those years as a almost permanent presence in Rome. This was incredible. I didn't have to go to Soho in Manhattan to experience that or be with my colleagues, because they were all colleagues of mine, all young people like me. They came to Rome. But yet more importantly was meeting Anthony Braxton, George Lewis, the Chicago Arts Ensemble, and all of the powerful, powerful Afro-American improvisers and radical improvisers, radical people in Rome and in Europe in general. And if I want to go so far as to say thanks to the Italian Communist Party, who brought them here every month in a certain period in the 70s.
Yeah, that's
this was a policy.
Absolutely.
This was a party policy run by Filippo
Bianchi.
And there you have a whole very interesting political, cultural, musical history, which is incredible, which didn't go as far as it could have gone. But there was more Afro-American music of the free jazz, so-called free jazz kind, in Italy than there was anywhere else in the world at
that
time.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, yeah. Even better than in France, where there was another strong community of Black American expatriates in the 60s, late 60s, I would say.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, yeah. But it's curious because this concentration and this coming together of young American, well-educated musicians like you, like Frederick Richard and the others.
Thank you for the compliment. I like the well-educated part.
Yes, you were. You are. And you came here just because there was a policy of the State Department of the United States to encourage exchanges in a way, but probably what the American government didn't expect is that you became revolutionary individuals when
and
you
opposed,
were
and opposed to
and
American,
opposed to American,
to American
when you were here.
Political policy.
So this is
okay. Let me just be clear. Neither Frederick, only Richard Teitelbaum was actually sponsored by the Fulbright exchange program. Both Frederick and I, Frederick for different reasons, moved to Rome with his wife and family, but reasons where he was already in the early 60s, the accompanist of the
Gazzaloni
and playing all of the music of Boulez and Stockhausen and all of that.
I understand that he came with an exchange program to Berlin first, I think.
The DAAD,
that's
right, and so did I.
Ah, so did
you. Yeah, but the DAAD is not an official American thing. It was a German program, a cultural program, exchange program, which at that time invited Elliot Carter in 1964 And Elliot Carter, in turn, had the option to invite two or three young composers to accompany him in this DAAD program, and those were Frederick, myself. So anyway, to Berlin, that was purely a German creation, and the very, very first year of that DAAD program. I personally came to Rome purely, let's say, speculatively, just looking, you know, for a nice warm place in the sun and good food after spending 1 year residency in Berlin at that time in the early 60s, which was very, very sad and cold and dark.
There must have been something really attractive in the Rome environment. I mean, from a musical point of view.
Well, even from, yes, from a musical point of view, I would say not only was there a this very strong presence of the Nuova Consonanza group, but there were also within the RAI radio world possibilities for commissions and performances. At that time, the Italian radio was very much like all of the other European radios, and they were producing new music, producing it themselves with their own musicians and with their own in their own recording studios. So this is before the powers of television completely wiped out the classical music world, even in the radio. So all the money went to the television, and the radio was just left, surviving. Still survives. So there was a kind of a normal musical life that offered some kind of hopeful possibilities for young composers. Not that they could make a life alone in Rome with their music, but at least that there was a community, a general culture, and a welcoming spirit.
There was also an art community.
A very big art community, a very important one. And this also had a very, very strong, at that time, not so much in music, with the exception of this exceptional Fabio Sargentini and his gallery, who centered their focus on American experimental visual artists, dance and music. So they took all of the aspects. There was no dance in Rome at that time, no modern dance, almost none. But anyway, the whole downtown scene came. Joan Jonas, Tricia Brown, with whom I was associated for many years, and also with Joan Jonas, and all of these people I met in Rome, and later collaborated with in the succeeding years. So there was a rich and vital something going on. I can't put my finger on it, but all of these things from the improvised music situation, all forms of experimental art, and especially, let's not forget the very vital scene that was going on in Rome in experimental theater with Mario Martone, Meme Perlini, I can't think of all of the names. But anyway, this provided for me personally continuous work, making music for these experimental theater events, which were largely focused on image rather than on the word. So the spoken word was less interesting or less used, and image and sound were the new elements that were very strong, especially in the work of Perlini. So anyway, yes, all of these things came together to as a rich broth, un brodo, really.
Zuppa.
A zuppa. that really fed us all. I mean, it was No one thought that they would become rich from any of this, but the possibility to live from day to day, yes, mm-hmm. that was happening. This was extremely important. And even in the early MEV years, of course, MEV was self-supporting, and we became very quickly recognized, especially in the European area, through the European radios, who all wanted, you know, the latest, newest, radical-sounding, crazy improvisations, which were not at all happening in the European classical avant-garde music world.
And speaking of this, I would like to point out how were the relationships between what emerged from your community, mostly non-Italian musicians in Rome, developing these concepts of free improvisation, and the Italian or almost Italian group of Nuova Consonanza, who was born somehow a little earlier than you, but more or less in the same time.
Were maybe 65, we were 66.
Exactly.
Just a year difference.
But do you think that it was just just one movement or two separate ideas?
Well, we were already aware that, and then quickly there was. Groups in France and Spain and less in Germany, but there were other groups beginning to appear who were really very, very good improvising groups. And the differences between Nuova Consonanza and MEV were very, very simple. MEV were anarchists, and Nuova Consonanza were traditional, under a traditional rigorous idea of leadership of Franco Evangelisti, who had the idea and insisted on a kind of a musical purity.
And a discipline also.
In a discipline. MEV insisted on none of those things. Were completely dedicated to the liberation of themselves, their instruments, their ideas, mm-hmm. From all of that tradition of leader, score, having a partitura, having
And even instrumental technique.
And even instrumental techniques.
Because, well, I mean, when I think of your past and your background as a pianist, Frederick was and still is, of course,
yes.
And Richard too.
Yes, also.
I mean, you broke the rules. You just practically left the piano, the tempered system,
absolutely.
Everything.
Well, in fact, there was...
And that had a permanent impact of the music that you had done after that.
Absolutely, absolutely. In fact, Frederick symbolically and realistically abandoned the piano by announcing, "I'm never going to play the piano again." And he took up a piece of glass in the shape of a piano and began to scratch the glass. That was his glass piano. And this became the symbolic break. Mm-hmm. With the past, mm-hmm. where he really left the piano, mm-hmm. and of course he.
But we know
he went back to the
how the ended story ended. Yeah. It's not ended,
and
of course.
Was quickly playing Beethoven again,
because also he made a living with.
He made a living. Yes, right. This was his life.
Well, yeah,
and still is.
Which brings me to another question. Said, of course, at that time life was very cheap.
Cheap, yeah.
But how did you make a living when doing all of this non-economically rewarding activities, I would say?
Well, we made a living. I mean, the MEV group itself provided a continuous 5 years while we were continuously together from 1966 to 71 in Rome. Before Frederick left for New York and Richard left for Toronto, where he went to study, and eventually went out to California, to California School of the Arts. And the truth is, we were living from day to day, just like, as they say in Rome, you know, alla giornata. And this suited us. There was no problem, because the request for our performances in Northern Europe, let's say Switzerland, Austria, Germany, France, Holland, Denmark, Sweden, the whole of, I mean, these were became constant requests. So there was always money coming into the group, and this money was just was enough for all of us to live on. Even those with family, or those, most of us didn't have children. But I would supplement, personally supplement my money by doing, I actually was introduced to a small company, an important company in Rome, who at that time was doing animated films. And I was writing scores for animation. And occasionally I would be called, this was more in the early 70s, I would be called to do a recording, let's say at RCA, to play a synthesizer part.
I mean, you worked like a studio musician.
I played for Johnny Morandi.
Really?
In a recording, yeah. It was a song that Morandi was presenting at Sanremo. And you know, we have to win, and it's all about winning the prize, the premio. He did not win. Mm-hmm. I forget who won the prize that year, but it would be interesting to find out this piece, this Johnny Morandi piece. I would love to hear that again, because I was very impressed by the arrangement. But I must say, the synthesizer part, which was only playing a kind of bass tuba, a bass tuba, these kind of sounds, you know, mm-hmm. that were really great on the mm-hmm. on the synthesizer. So I was actually, yeah, so anyway, that I supplemented, and I began, of course, in the early 70s, when Mev already was not living anymore together in Rome. We were working around the world, but we were not all in Rome. So I began immediately, I was working in the early 70s, of course, mostly with the young experimental theater people. And there was, you know, it wasn't big money, but I was living okay. And even, you know, I was doing a little film music, a little bit of this and that, you know, yeah.
So after the initial outburst of liberation, liberating the score, liberating the instruments, so you went quickly back to music writing.
I never stopped it.
Never, ever.
Mm-hmm. No, in fact, there was no contradiction. There was mm-hmm. no contradiction, because, to be honest, and this is one of the themes I maybe, mm-hmm. I hinted at in my email to you, mm-hmm. but one of the important themes to me in this whole period, at the end of the 20th century and the beginning of the 21st century, is this fusion, or not fusion, between composition and improvisation. And this place in time and in space and in culture, in the cultural mind of our time, where these two things, which were considered totally contradictory, are now becoming thought of as almost one and the same, at least by myself. As you stress continuously and happily, you know, I'm a cultured, trained composer. I'm studying with the great Elliot Carter, and then being inspired by early music of Luigi Nono, for example. he was one of my first mm-hmm. inspirations. Luciano Berio, mm-hmm. at the same time, piece mm-hmm. called Circles. I thought, man, mm-hmm. this is the kind of music I want to write.
Yeah.
And I saw the score and I looked at this beautiful graphics, beautiful notes. Also, a mix mm-hmm. of improvisation and a mix of written mm-hmm. thing along mm-hmm. a mm-hmm. flowing timeline. This is music. And these musics now mm-hmm. are in fact the powerful, still very powerful, underlying mm-hmm. Foundations of musical composition today. When you go to the conservatories, this is, if you're lucky, this is, you learn these scores.
Yeah.
I discovered this music, I don't know how I discovered this music. The music that interested me the most was, in fact, the Italian avant-garde, period. Even Petrassi, that whole world.
There was
Dalla Piccola was, I loved his music.
Yeah. There was a circulation of this music in the States.
We had all the scores.
You had all the scores. Sure.
America is a rich place, and mm-hmm. the universities grabbed these materials immediately,
mm-hmm.
and so this wasn't any. That music was available when I was a student. I don't know how, but there it was.
So you mean that getting to know the music of the Italian composer of the time through the scores that were available at your
right.
university
scores and
was an important factor in prompting you to
Absolutely.
Maybe having the idea to come here?
For sure. Not the original, the idea of coming here, of course, was more seeing the Italian realist cinema of the post-war. And this gave me, Rocco e Suoi Fratelli, all these films. It takes place right here in Milano. And I didn't understand what all of this was about. A young mm-hmm. American couldn't not understand what the World War II was, except some heroic victory for the United States. I had family who came back with German pistols in their.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean they fought in the war.
Sure.
My father nearly had to go fight, but he turned out he was 35 years old, so they said, okay, you can stay here. And he had to work in a factory, which in fact made rifles. He was making pieces, putting mm-hmm. rifles. But so but our conception of what this war was completely like a Hollywood fantasy. We had no idea what this meant. We didn't know about destruction and death.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, all of those things. It just didn't hear it. It was, everybody knew because the bombs were falling here, and not so much on Milano and Genova or whatever. But anyway, there were problems that were mm-hmm. Huge here, and it was inconceivable. So, nonetheless, my attraction to the Italian cinema was something that was, I think, more on an emotional level, some powerful expressiveness about the people who, while clearly not living this luxurious life of the 1950s that we did in the United States, were in possession of a consciousness and a creative energy that we knew nothing about.
So there was a curiosity about this
really,
different culture and
this
way of, I mean, outliving.
Well, it was
the war.
It's the mm-hmm. not only, but mm-hmm. There was something about the Mediterranean in general that mm-hmm. there was an attraction, as if yes, we all belong here. We all come from here. Like I could feel myself. If I lived here, I could feel at home, and so I have for 55 years. lived here.
Mm-hmm. But you didn't think at that time that you had that you had been
never no. So
eventually became
so yes, and then this is even further confirmed by my youthful attraction to Luigi Nono's Canto Sospeso, and particularly Luciano Berio's Circles. Mm-hmm. These pieces, which oh my God, this is beautiful music. This is the music. I was not so much attracted to Elliot Carter's music, which was much more
difficult
and
complex.
Let's simply say unlyrical, not lyrical. Whereas the atonality of Nono and Berio was like lirico. Mm-hmm. It was singing, cantabile. It was another thing. It was beautiful. Simply put.
Okay.
It was beautiful music.
Yeah, simply put. But you didn't have real relations with those composers.
No.
That's the curious aspect.
Well, the weird thing is I actually did receive my story is I received a Fulbright scholarship to study with Berio, and he accepted me. And at that time, he was living, I believe,
in the United States.
No, he was
because
in
Milan. It depends on the year. Because
was he in Venice? I don't know.
He was Berio had moved to the United States because he taught a couple of years at the Mills College.
At Mills College, that's right. Yeah. But in any case, it was not at Mills College because it was to be in Europe.
It was in New York.
It
was in the States at that time.
I don't know. So this was
64,
65. 64, yes. It would be end of 63, 64. And then this is when Elliot Carter telephoned me and said, I'd like to invite you to Berlin. And so I had to disdire with Berio. This is interesting.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, Richard, of course, who was my roommate in Yale, went to study with Nono.
With Nono.
Yeah.
And he actually was one of the very few pupils. But I know that he didn't last.
Very.
I know he didn't.
They didn't get along.
I know. Where, well, from the other part. but it's curious to say that on those years, maybe this is not very well known, but this is a side observation that we can make, that why there wasn't those two families of musicians didn't get along. It was precisely the time when Nono started working with improvisation. And actually, from the mid-60s on, his pieces, his compositions were largely based on actual improvisations by the vocal performers and also instrumentalists that he worked with.
Is that so? This I'm not aware of. I didn't know that. Well, I'm happy to hear that.
Yeah, but because it was a moment when improvisation was starting to be important. Well, I mean, Stockhausen.
Right.
He absorbed
Stockhausen
some energy.
He took from Musik Elektronik.
I think so.
No, I know. He came to hear us.
Yes, I know that.
In Dortmund or Düsseldorf. And he said, aha. And then immediately, that was 1967.
Yeah.
He formed his own group. But it was a group conducted by Stockhausen. Controlled by Stockhausen. So, again, he never relinquished control to the real improvisers. He was composing with them and on them and by them, through them. All of this I find extremely interesting. These little details of times and overlapping influences and of course I think Franco Evangelisti himself in the circle of Italian composers was clearly out there. He was and a very powerful attracting force in his idea about liberating the music from the score, from the written page. In fact, I mean, I always tell this story. When I came to Rome, Evangelisti was one of the first people I met, and he says, tu sei compositore, and so he gave me tu or lei, I don't remember. I said, yeah, sì, sono compositore. He says, ma non sai che non c'è più musica da scrivere? He said that. He said, don't you know there's no more music to write? And I said, wow. This is my first meeting with this guy. He was really out there. Mm-hmm. He believed. Mm-hmm. Because it was more like a... it was a faith, it was in fede, it was a philosophy, it was, mm-hmm. He had to change the system. He wanted to change the system. Mm-hmm. It's like Christian Wolff's piece,
changing the system. Yeah. But you were more successful in changing the system.
Mev, certainly.
I mean, your practice was...
Well, we had no,
it was radical in another way, but probably more.
At the time, absolutely.
Because you also had this, you were more open to bring together other cultures.
Yeah.
I was listening to one of your last records, which is the Endangered Species. Which is fascinating because it brings together many things.
Oh, yeah.
There is your more recent work with samples.
Well,
but there is
that's 30 years.
30 years, but I mean, technically, I mean.
It's the latest development
of your working with samples.
Bravo, yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
And together there is a strong piano playing,
yeah.
But in a vein which is not exactly experimental per se.
No,
but it's just a reinterpretation of standards.
Absolutely.
Which is brings together also the tradition of the musical, but also jazz improvisation.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Well, that music is also, I mean, I have more than one musical foundation. I have, of course, the classical continuity from wherever you want to start, from Hildegard von Bingen to the present. Mm-hmm. And I also have the history of American jazz in my own blood, mm-hmm. which is even much closer to me than the European classical music.
Sure.
Because this music, I not only did I have it in my family, but it was the music that enabled me to pay my way through my studies and university and things like that. I was playing all the time in dance bands.
Dance bands.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Like a big band. Uh-huh. Big band, small band. But anyway, mm-hmm. this kind of music. So, mm-hmm. like many people, Terry Riley, Lamont Young were all jazz players.
Sure.
And it was shocking to meet people later in life that I admired so much, like John Cage and my dear friend Elliot Carter, who hated jazz. They didn't hate jazz, but they
it was not viable.
It was not mm-hmm. part for yes, it even for Cage it enters into his music mm-hmm. and one or two pieces. I forget the early piece of 1940s.
Credo in Us.
Thank you very much. Yeah, mm-hmm. memory. I'm losing memory. My memory. Yeah. You get old. You things. But anyway, but Carter. I remember going to dinner with the Carters in New York because I saw them all the time, and I liked to meet with them. And we went to a restaurant, and we were eating, and suddenly a trio, piano, bass, and drums, starts to play. And Elliot says, ah, that music, they always have to have a beat.
That was also Kate's problem.
It was the beat.
The beat.
The beat. Because their life was dedicated to destroying the beat, which they successfully did.
Yeah.
especially Cage.
Especially Cage.
Atlas Eclipticalis. You can't have more no beat music. It doesn't exist. non esiste. Well, you have to be crazy if you could hear a pulse in that music. But we're living with this. Coming back to what you said about endangered species, I mean, I was simply saying, restating the fact that American popular music is one of the most important parts of my musical education. Simple as that, period.
Ah. Well, I think we should dobbiamo andare avanti a parlare.
Sarebbe bellissimo di
farlo. Sì, dobbiamo fare una mettere serie. Insieme, sì.
No, perché tra interviste e interviste quali ne ho fatto centinaia. I'll say this in English because talking with you is like talking to someone who really knows what I'm talking about.
Thank you.
No, seriously, it's wonderful.
I think I shared some parts of the experience.
I think you do, yeah. I think you share a lot.
Okay.
Great. Good.